You think evolution is true, but you think that there are problems with natural selection. That's what you said?
Yeah, I think there's an issue with selection four, and that it can't actually make any predictions.
Oh, that's weird. There's like a Journal of Evolutionary Biology. I mean, like,
Yeah,
scientists
mine is
do.
an op.
Oh, sorry, go
Yeah,
ahead.
mine's an a priori objection, so the empirical data isn't really gonna matter. My
I'm.
argument is that in principle, natural selection can't disambiguate co-founding or coextensive traits.
Okay, so is this the F Jeremy? What was his first name? I don't remember. Jeremy Fodor's argument or whatever against natural selection?
Yeah, it's similar to that, yeah.
Okay. Do you like? Can you just make the case in a succinct way without like rambling for a super long time? Because I'm not really sure
Sure, I
what
mean,
exactly to respond to.
yeah, I mean, do you know like any bit of Fodor's argument, or do you just want me to kind of start fresh?
Yeah, I did a 2-hour debate on this once.
Okay. Well, I guess what matters is understanding like what are called intentional and extensional contexts. So if you think about an intentional, or if we talk about some type of like extensional context, we can say some like causal mechanism is like a extensional context. So if we say something like the dodgy wire in the attic caused, the fire. In an extensional context, we can swap out co-referential terms like fire and smoke. In this case, where there's fire, there's smoke. And we'll preserve truth value of the proposition. So we can say it's true that the dodgy wire caused the fire, and replace fire with smoke, and it's true that the fire caused the smoke, right? And so we can change out these co-referential terms and preserve the truth value. But what natural selection purports to be is an intentional context that it can actually select for some phenotypic trait, as opposed to maybe like a free rider or like a ride along, right? Which makes it an intentional context. Something
Sure.
like if Lois Lane, so extensional context like, Clark Kent can fly, Superman can fly. We can replace Clark Kent, Superman, and we preserve truth value. But if we did something like Lois Lane believes Superman can fly, if we change that out with Clark Kent, that proposition risks not becoming true anymore because she doesn't know that Clark Kent is Superman. And so we risk not preserving the truth value once we swap out those co-referential terms. And so the analogy here is just that natural selection is something that selects for some phenotypic trait, such that it can disambiguate between the free rider. So if we say that some population with hearts survives and some other population without hearts doesn't survive, we could appeal to like the pumping of the heart or like the thump thump sounds that the heart produces, right?
Yep.
But clearly, like we look at the world and we don't think that like the thump thump sounds have any effect. Like we clearly know that the pumping of the blood is responsible for survival. And so if natural selection can do what it purports to do, it should be able to disambiguate those two co-founding variables. But given that it's this like causal mechanism, we're not going to be able to swap out the co-referential traits and be able to determine which one we're selected for. We're only going to be able to show which traits were selected of. And so if natural selection is this process at which or mechanism at which can determine what is selected for, then it can't do what it purports to do.
Right. So again, I've already had this discussion, but I think there's a one of the issues is you can't tell if natural selection is selecting just traits or like because it can't distinguish between the free riders or whatever, but That's really not the case because traits can be linked. So let's say that, do you know who Dmitry Belyaev was?
I do not.
So he was this very famous Russian I don't know if he was a geneticist or an evolutionary biologist or whatever, but he did this.
Is he the guy that like coined pleiotropy?
Pleiotropy? I don't think so, but he did this
I'm thinking someone else, sorry.
He did this domesticated fox experiment, and for all I know, this experiment is still going on. So what they did was they selectively bred foxes. I think I might have said wolves, but they were foxes. Selectively bred them to be more docile, and there was one trick. Would they let them be fed by hand without like biting the hand that fed them? And that was it. And obviously, generation after generation, the foxes became more and more like receptive toward humans. But as that happened, they also got floppy ears, their tails became curly, their coats became not exactly spotted, but like the dark and the light patterns in their coat separated, like what domesticated animals have. Think of like a Dalmatian or a beagle or a dairy cow, you know. All of these traits that had nothing to do with what they were selecting for, because it turned out that those traits are like in close proximity on chromosomes to the traits that they actually are selecting for. So it actually is the case, like even a trait that seems irrelevant, like we're trying to pick something. Let me just actually read you the trait I came up with. Let's say that people who are immune to some disease also have no fingerprints. Not having fingerprints isn't helping them survive, and so natural selection can't tell us why that trait is being selected for. But free riders are selected for because they are linked to other genes. So if the free rider is baggage to the gene being selected for, then the gene being selected for is also baggage for that free rider. So that means even an irrelevant characteristic still provides an evolutionary advantage. So yes, in this case, having no fingerprints does predict how likely you are to be immune to whatever that disease is.
So I'm not seeing, though, how that's the case. Like, if you're just, it seems like you're conceding the argument at that point. Like, if you're saying that you could
have... No, I'm saying that the problem isn't a problem.
But it would be a problem, like if we're supposed to be able to say what phenotypic trait leads to fixation in a population, which Fodor, myself, you all agree is a fact of the matter, right? We all agree that there's some phenotypic trait that like leads to fixation, reproductive success in a population, right? We don't want some type of like godlike introduction into our theory, right? Because that's not scientific, right? So we want to avoid those types of explanations, but also looking at what's purported by the theory, and the theory is purported to be able to say which phenotypic traits are selected upon, right? Natural selection is talking about what phenotypic traits are selected for. I don't see how talking about the genotype or anything like that's going to help you. Especially like,
well, because
like, you can talk about things like selective sweep and stuff like that, but the problem would still remain regardless of like selective sweep or...
Well, I think it does for a couple other reasons that I haven't unpacked. One, natural selection doesn't select for traits. The level of selection is the gene. That was the revolution that Richard Dawkins came up with in the 70s when he wrote The Selfish Gene. The only thing that actually gets selected for are the genes themselves. So we're not selecting for I don't know, like the ability to be immune for blank. It's just a gene that corresponds with that. And there are very few genes for one specific thing. I'm not exactly sure where I was going with that, but it's really complicated, I guess.
I agree that it is. I guess I'm just confused that like it doesn't seem like it's seems like, I don't know, I might not just understanding your response, and so there might be just, you know, failure on my part, so I leave that open. But I guess what I'm not understanding is how it isn't a concession if what seems to be stated is that it's true, natural selection in the case of a free rider can't actually determine what it's selected for. Because, I mean, like, think about it this way. Like, think about if I just had this box of crickets and I throw crickets into the box that has like a filter at the bottom.
Right.
And it weeds out the crickets. And me and you go back, we look at the box and what comes out of the, so we throw black crickets or a whole bunch of crickets in there, and we notice that the crickets that survive are black and have wings. Right. And we could like assess, given when we throw all the crickets into the box and we get winged crickets, but what remains are wingless crickets. Like, it's easy for me and you to look at that without employing any theory at all that what the reproductive advantage was something like flight to get away from predators in the box or whatever. And that's why they survived and could get out of the funnel outside of the other side of the box, and they survive. But like, if it just turns out that I can also appeal to the blackness, because where I get blackness, I get the wingness, then what we're saying is that that mechanism, the box, isn't selecting for like the wingness. It's selecting of these traits. And so it's just not clear that natural selection is something that actually tells us what phenotypic trait. Actually, me and you and my grandmother can just go out and look at some ecology and go, yeah, it's clear that like the things with longer necks are going to survive because they can reach the trees. You don't need any theory. Like, so like, in other words, biologists are making predictions. They're making successful predictions, but they're not invoking the theory of natural selection, right? Because especially if we just concede that we can't actually disambiguate between the phenotypic traits, because then in virtue of what? It's clearly some like ancestral understanding or historical understanding of ecology, right? Something that we just observe with our eyes. I don't think you need a theory of natural selection to tell me that things with hearts will survive and the things without hearts won't, right?
Well, why else would they survive? Or like, what else would explain that organisms that lack specific traits don't survive as well as other ones?
Because it's like telling me that you want to play the stock market, and that you want to know, like, you're like, Jay Mike, you know, you play a really good game in the stock market, but how is it that like you actually come to some conclusion of like what principle that I should like, you know, buy into, right? Should I buy into like I want to play the game of the stock market? How, like, what should I do? And I just tell you, buy low, sell high, right? That clearly will explain every dollar that you make or that you sell, right? Or every dollar that you make or every dollar that you lose, right? But yeah, it's not going to tell you what stocks you should buy, how the corporate ladder works, and what predictions you should make. And if it turns out that it's just trivially true that organisms with some phenotypic trait that me and you can observe, you know, survive in some population, I didn't have to invoke any theory.
Yeah, but again, it's not about the phenotypic trait. It's about the genes.
So, because, so then you disagree with that.
And also, natural selection selects against, not for. There's a selection
pressure on phenotypic traits?
There is, but the traits aren't being selected for. It's the genes. But also,
there's standard understanding in real biology quick, and real quick, like the classes I've taken in college was that there's selection.
Are you hearing me?
Traits. Yeah, you said it's selected on the genotype.
Yeah, and then I said, hold on, because I had more things to say. But also, natural selection, like, you keep saying things that, like, I think that they make your argument work, but I think they're just fundamentally flawed, which is that traits don't get selected for, genes do, and natural selection selects against, not for, things.
Against is still an intentional context. Like Alex Rosenberg gave this response, and that doesn't help you. Selection against is still intentional with an S, not intentional with a T. It's still something that if you change the coextensive traits, you don't preserve truth value. So changing selection for and selection against doesn't actually absolve the problem. It concedes the problem. Like someone like Alex Rosenberg, who wants to suggest selection against, is just conceding the problem.
I don't see how that's the case.
Because selection against is intentional. Think about it. If I select, like, selection, and when we talk about an intentional context, like I said, we risk preserving the truth value. And so if it's you're selecting against this trait, this free rider or something, as opposed to this other trait that leads to success, that's the same problem, because it's not like I swap out the two traits and I preserve truth value, right? Like think like a polar bear, for example, being selected for its whiteness as opposed to being selected for its camouflaging into its environment, those don't mean the same thing. If I swap those two out, I risk preserving truth value, because being selected for its whiteness might not mean camouflaging into its environment.
Yeah, but you could test whether or not that is the case. Like these hypotheticals that you propose exist in a vacuum. And
they don't.
Science is not armchair philosophy. We actually do test these things out.
But this isn't about empirical tests. This is an a priori objection. This is no different than if, like, we took objection that you can't have true contradictions, and we say that, like, you know, the Schrodinger's interpretation of quantum mechanics, it invokes some, like, contradiction, right?
Yeah.
And if that's the case, that's then great, it's an a priori objection to the theory.
That's great. But this is just a convoluted grammatical trick that only works in the imaginary land of ideas where nothing ever happens. That's not science. That's why I find these conversations to be utterly useless.
So you don't think that you don't think that you can show that some scientific or empirical theory in principle can't do what it purports to do? Because that doesn't involve an empirical analysis. That involves just looking at the desiderata that you invoke, and then whether or not those things can actually do what they purport to do. If it turns out that in principle they can't, you don't need to do any empirical research to show that some empirical theory can't do what it purports to do in principle. I just need to show you what you're
okay,
committed
that
to.
That made
reductio show you can't do that.
Yeah. So that made absolutely no sense. So can you explain that in a better way?
If you saw something traveling faster, faster than light,
do you not think that
in principle would defeat a lot?
I thought you told me that we don't.
Something that would falsify specific theories we have, right?
I thought you said this had nothing to do with empiricism or empirical data.
Yeah, but I'm trying to get on your level and show you something in the world we could observe so that I can get back to the point.
Well, don't appeal to an empirical observation to tell me that empirical observations.
That's fine. Then I'll just go, yeah, that's fine. So, like, in principle, if we could show, like, I don't know, that there are true contradictions or that some logical axioms or something hold, that might affect whether or not some interpretation on quantum mechanics, right? It might not be as much of a problem for some interpretation, like a Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics, like someone might want to point out, right?
Right, was there a thought in there? Because I didn't catch it.
Okay, so like this is really simple. If
no,
you have
not.
Some empirical theory, in principle, I don't have to do any work at all in the world to show you that your theory can't get off the ground if it can't do what it purports to do in principle.
How do you know that? How do you know whether or not it can do what it purports to do in principle?
By giving you the argument that selection
an argument doesn't prove
is an intentional context and causal mechanisms are an extensional context.
That's a grammatical trick.
It's not a
grammatical
trick.
The real world is, yes, it is. These are made up words that mean nothing.
How is this an objection?
Really? Well, I'm trying to tell you. So these words, all words, their meaning is declared by fiat. At some point, somebody just says, this is what this means. It says nothing about whether or not it actually is true in the universe or whatever. So, like, you can argue that all of these things going on in our model, well, they're, we have all of these problems because of intentionality, so on and so forth. So so basically, it sounds like you're saying natural selection contains logical contradictions, and we don't even have to test.
I didn't say that at all. I said that natural selection is purported to be an intentional context, and causal mechanisms are an extensional context. We risk preserving the truth value when we point out these phenotypic traits. What I'm pointing out is that natural selection cannot disambiguate between what phenotypic trait was selected for, because I can tell the same exact story with the thumping of the heart. Like, think of it this way. Yep. We go look at a population of organisms with hearts and without hearts, right? And the ones without hearts don't survive. That didn't, by the way, that didn't take any theory for us to, like, predict that, right? We can just, like, know how anatomy works and understand that things without hearts are probably not going to survive, or things that have hearts that degenerate over time will probably not survive. We go back, the population with hearts survive, but there's phenotypic traits we can appeal to, like the thumping of the heart. We can appeal to the pumping of the heart. And me and you clearly know it's the pumping of the heart, the mechanism of the heart that aids in the reproductive success. But I can tell you the same story by appealing to a phenotypic trait, like the thumping of the heart. Now, if we don't want the same story, which we don't want to be able to say that what was selected for was the thumping of the heart, which gives us the same reproductive success as appealing to the pumping of the blood. It gives us the same, but I appeal to a different phenotypic trait, a ride along, and tell the same story. Now, if natural selection wants to tell us something that's not trivial, it needs to be able to disambiguate and tell us which phenotypic trait was selected for. That's the problem.
The problem is natural selection doesn't select traits. It selects genes. So there's an enormous misunderstanding right off the bat.
But none of selecting genes, like, this is like a common response I get. I don't see how selecting for the genotype solves the problem. Like, when you think that it selects for the genotype rather than the phenotype, what problem do you think is absolved?
Not the genotype, genes.
Okay, when it's selected for whatever set of genes, how is that absolving the problem that what comes along with those genes is another phenotypic trait that's a ride-along?
Because it doesn't select for traits, it selects for genes.
Yeah. So
you just said, "Oh, the genes don't help." Because what if you point to the genotype, but you still get this other phenotype? Like, you keep bringing up non sequiturs. As far as I'm concerned,
I'm not bringing up a non sequitur.
Then stop talking about traits. Like, come up with an argument on the level of the gene, which is what is actually selected for.
All right. Well, one, I don't like being the pulling up, like, sources police, because I just don't like that tactic. But, like, I've talked to so many biologists, and not a single one of them disagree that it's their selection for on the phenotype. But even if you did, selecting on the genotype doesn't, like, absolve the problem. Right? Look, I'm an atheist.
Why not?
I don't believe God exists. I think, in fact, God does not exist. I'm not, like, some creationist, right? I think evolution is true. I think that
selecting at the level of genes is still a problem?
Because it doesn't, because this the phenotypic trait that rides along in whatever case that you give,
it doesn't select for phenotypic traits.
Okay, so you think that backing up the problem and talking about selecting for the genes all of a sudden paints a different picture, that there's no longer the ride along trait?
So again, the right along.
It's not like it erases it. This is why selective sweep or like pleiotropy or any of these things aren't like a solution to the problem, right? Like, I would love a solution to the problem. I've been looking for a solution to the problem for years. Like, this is an issue. This is an a priori objection to the theory. And obviously, evolution isn't dependent on natural selection. Me and you would both agree to that. There's several mechanisms, right? I mean, right. This doesn't, like, even change the landscape of biology. What the force of the argument is that biologists are smarter than the theory that they're invoking. They're way smarter than the theory. They're making predictions. But they're not invoking natural selection to do that.
Yeah, I mean, I just disagree. So again, you know, the free rider, if we analyze this on the level of the gene, then those free rider traits, again, that's just a hypothetical. In the real world, like my example about the disease, like if you're immune to disease, you don't have fingerprints. That's not real. I made that up. Okay.
I can give you real examples. Camouflaging into one's environment and being white. That's a real, those are two phenotypic traits. You can't swap
them out. Yeah, so you can test whether or not
the value of the proposition.
Yeah, you'd have to experimentally verify that.
Yeah, but what kind of mechanism is this that when I change it out in different boxes, or I change it out in different ecosystems, that it doesn't even hold and doesn't give me any novel predictive success? That when what I'm supposed to be able to do is when its selected forest camouflaging into the environment, that I can swap it out with its whiteness, and then I go to some other, like I can put on a white shirt, go all out white right now, and it's not going to camouflage me into my environment just by having that phenotypic trait, right? It's clearly not going to preserve the truth value once I swap those two phenotypic traits out with each other. But a causal mechanism like the dodgy wire in the attic causing the fire, when I replace that with smoke, that works, because a causal mechanism that's responsible for the fire, responsible for the smoke, I can transfer those things out with no problem. And given that natural selection is supposed to be some causal mechanism, right, that's supposed to hold. But it doesn't hold. It turns out that when I swap out the ride-along trait, I don't preserve truth value of the proposition.
What ride-along trait? You told me whiteness blending into the environment and whiteness, and then you said something about wearing a shirt.
Frogs snapping at flies versus snapping at ambient dots, right? Which we have empirical evidence for. There's several examples that Fodor even gives in his book. But it's just not, like you say, you don't see it's a problem, but like it's not even clear to me that you even know what Fodor's argument is. So like, could I ask you to steel man what the argument's supposed to be? Because the problem that I run into when I talk with people about this is that they reject Fodor's argument without even understanding what it is.
I listened to a debate that he did about this, and Danny sent me some stuff about him. Basically, the crux of the problem seems to be we can't distinguish whether or not whether or not natural selection is specifically selecting for these certain traits or characteristics or whatever, or if it's, I'm probably not going to be able to give a good description of the argument, if I'm being honest. The whole intentionality
that,
and extensionality thing
you can have an objection
just doesn't make any sense to me. But
okay, but look, so I appreciate the honesty, but I don't understand how you think the argument doesn't work if you don't understand the argument.
Well, because you keep saying things that are critically flawed, like that it selects traits. It doesn't. It selects genes, right?
I'm literally looking at something on my left, on my Oculus, right now, and it says, like on the Wikipedia, it says selects four phenotypic traits.
Okay. Pop science is often inaccurate and belies the truth of things. People that study physics and especially like quantum mechanics will tell you this.
I have a hobby of going to thrift stores and buying biology books. I have eight of them on my desk. I will pull up every one of them, and every single one of them will say selects for phenotypic traits. Every single one of them.
Okay.
And that's why I said, even if I just ignore that,
every single high school science textbook
doesn't change the
problem.
This is what you see on every photo video. Someone's like, oh, genes. And then every comment beyond that's, how does that solve the problem? And the person who initially suggested it never comments back, because they don't even know what they're saying.
Yeah,
they just think it's a way out.
Yeah. Every single science textbook will show you the planetary Bohr model, which is wrong. So, like, there are lots of things that, like, in pop science, I'm a science teacher. There are all kinds of things I say to my students, and I'm like, oh, that's not really how it works. But they're 16 years old, and this is the only useful way to communicate
with
them.
I think you have to, honestly, I think you have to kind of do certain things in educational settings to like phase people into, right? Like, I can understand 100%, but I don't know that that's the problem here, because I don't think it's like lying about it being selected for phenotypic traits, right? But I agree with you. I think that there are I don't like how certain normative language is used in like examples of factories with cells, because it gives creationists this like weird, you know, talking point to run with, that like, oh, it's like a cell in a factory, and who, you know, there has to be a person that runs the factory, and right, like, I get it. I think it's a poor way, but you have to phase people into understanding the literature.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know that that's what's going on here. Like, I honestly think that if all biologists accepted Fodor's issue, virtually nothing would change about biology. They would just realize that other mechanisms are responsible, and that what natural selection is purporting to do is just something kind of trivial. Like, we can look out at the population. It's not hard to assess things that camouflage into their environment are going to have a better time. My grandmother could tell you that.
Has anything been proposed? Because we do experiments all the time.
Yeah, but the experiments and the predictions we make are not invoking natural selection. Right, when biologists are making novel predictions.
They're not invoking natural selection
to do that.
Yeah, and I asked for an alternative. Like, there's never even been one proposed that I'm aware
because
of.
Because I don't think there's a big hole in biology. I don't think that like acknowledging this puts a big hole in biology. Literally nothing. We are on a great track. We're on a good track in biology, in my opinion. This would virtually change nothing. All it would do is get biologists to realize a priori objections to theories are valuable, right? And we should recognize that when we've been making these predictions, we haven't been invoking this theory, because this theory has not been telling us what phenotypic trait is selected for, nor could we ever look in some future ecology and even give a novel prediction on what phenotypic trait is likely to be produced.
So something right? I don't think
that's necessarily a problem, but we can't do any of that.
So something I like to ask religious philbros or whatever when we're having these arguments, like, they say, well, you can't even justify and you're not making this argument, but like when they say, like, oh, you can't even justify empiricism, and you can't ground logic in logic,
well,
and
I'm
so
an
on
empiricist,
and so forth.
But...
What I like to ask them is, okay, let's just assume I adopt your worldview. What can you do that I cannot do? And none of them have ever come up with a response to that, which to me makes it sound like you're just trying to win an argument and do nothing else. Now, that whole thing you just said about what should we, like, what would be the proposed alternative? Like, oh, well, we don't even need one. I just want scientists to realize that they're not actually doing what they say they're doing. So in what world would this make us be able to, so this is not about being able to do new or better science.
Why do I have to have an alternative? That's not my claim.
If you're saying that it's false, then...
But the fact that I can point out that some theory in principle can't do what it purports to do doesn't infer that I have a solution, right? That doesn't make any sense. Like, I could just be one person who goes around and
then what's the point of
criticizes
empirical
theories and I happen to be right on them, but that doesn't mean that I have to have a solution.
Then what's
right?
The point
why,
of
why?
Bringing it
if
up?
I'm right about there being a problem with it, then why does it mean I need a solution? We're just stuck at, okay, this just doesn't have a solution, right, at the moment. We should do some work.
So that we can do what?
One, we have an option to be able to disambiguate the two phenotypic, the ride along, right, or be able to say what trait.
Okay, so the point
for.
Is
and
to be able
if
to
that
do
happens,
better
that's
science.
Great. Someone maybe in... What's called for somebody to do in this situation is to give an a priori counter objection to show that something goes wrong with the argument, right? Or that there's something wrong with the intentional extensional distinction, right? That's what they're called to do, because it's an a priori objection. It's an objection in principle to the theory. I don't need to go out in the world to be able to formulate this objection. The same way with any empirical theory, I don't have to go out in the world to formulate. I can just look at the language used and go, oh, there's an issue here.
So the purpose is to be able to do better science.
Well, that's always my goal. I mean, I think that's empirical science is vastly better for you know, okay. knowledge than just sitting in an armchair. But
right.
this so is precisely I'm not aware. Where I think that the armchair a priori considerations help. They help you in your theorizing.
Yep. I'm not aware of any paradigm shifts in science that ever happened from somebody just having a better argument. It was always like new empirically verified or verifiable like real world observations.
No, it's not true at all. We've had a priori objections to empirical theories all the time. There's like this isn't
what paradigm
like, something shift. If something in principle can't do what it purports to do, we discard it, right? And that's what that's just if you're saying that never happens, then I just don't know what world you live in.
Right. So I, what I said was, I'm not aware of any paradigm shifts in science that occurred because that occurred without evidence. Sorry,
it's not about a paradigm shift. It's just that.
Then what's the point?
What I'm saying is constitutive of scientific inquiry. We do this in science.
Perchance, could you tell me what that even means?
Theoretical physicists do this. This is what they do.
What do they
give
do?
A priori objections. They show in principle how something could work. They don't have to go out in the world to know that some phenomena that's being purported couldn't be true. Or given data they already know, they don't have to go in the world for future data to know that that thing can't be true, right?
Really? Because this sounds exactly like a creationist saying evolution can't explain why bees fly. Because what was that argument? It's physically impossible for a bee to fly. I can't remember why they said that was.
This has nothing to do with what I'm saying.
And then we realized, oh, when we actually did some further studies, some scientific studies, we discovered that bees flap their wings in a different way.
No scientific study is going to get you to the point where you say, oh, causal mechanisms turn out to be an intentional context. That is a philosophical issue that you have to absolve.
Well, I don't care.
Okay, well then if you don't care about an a priori objection that shows
no, I don't care about philosophical theory, then... arguments about well, it's like, so, well the case use of these words leads to an absurdity or a contradiction.
It's not whatever. About
I,
the abs-
I don't care about the imaginary land of ideas where nothing ever happens. I care okay, about so
you
don't results.
Do you, like, do you, could, you realize that words make up propositions that are true or false, right? Like we agree on that?
Can people hear me?
That's how we yes. That's how we use the language. Yeah. But one plus one equals two is only true in the sense that that's the rules of this thing called math that we invented.
So I wanted to jump in to say a few things, but the main one relevant to the point being discussed now is that as somebody who is both a self-ascribed philosophy asshole and a working scientist, I think the distinction that you're presenting, Peterson, is one that doesn't actually exist in terms of this division between experimental science and theoretical science. In the real world, what makes places like CERN and Fermilab and all of these advanced research facilities so exciting is that you have theoretical physicists and experimental physicists working together. The theoretical physicists are driving the ideas through largely a priori deductions and things like that.
That's
what it means when we say the math makes this happen. Those things are the basis on which we make a hypothesis and design an experiment, and then the experimental physicists design hardware and conduct the experiments to determine whether or not those a priori judgments based on the mathematics actually firm out, or if there was something about the deductions that were made or the math that was run that doesn't seem to line up with reality. It's not that one of these things is inherently better than the other. They are two halves of the practice of science. And you need both of them to arrive at anywhere.
Yeah, and I know. Way,
can I
know that.
Can I at least specify
the math
that I'm not
said that a nuclear reaction can't occur until the experiments verified that it can occur, right?
Right.
But what I've been hearing, Carl, are you J Mike?
Can I specify that every time that, like, for whatever reason, you keep saying that I'm religious and that I'm. I don't know if you're saying that directly, but I'm not religious.
Literally never once said anything.
Oh, okay.
Close
well,
to
sorry.
That.
Maybe I heard that wrong. That's why I wanted to specify.
What I kept hearing you say is something to the effect of, if it's wrong from the get-go, so like it's over. And it's like, yeah, that sounds like the whole, well, let's not even try to make a nuclear bomb because the nuclear reaction, or the, I can't remember what the heck you call it, but the sustained reaction or whatever, the math says it can't be done. They portray that really brilliantly in Oppenheimer. It's really cool. Or the thing about bees can't fly. So it like evolution can't explain that bees can fly because it's literally impossible. So throw away your theory. No, study it, investigate it, which is what you said, Cole. But I feel like, Carl, you're saying don't do that. And I'm just saying, like, this is useless.
I'll let Carl speak for himself. I don't think that's at all what he's saying. And that's why I wanted to jump in. I don't know if it's that you.
But your hypotheticals in a vacuum prove nothing.
Right. But
Cole understands what I'm saying. So let's
here's what I think you're missing. And by the way, I am not actually super familiar with the argument that Carl is ascribing. And because of that, I'm not willing to say that, like, yeah, I believe there is some merit to this. I jumped in the middle of this conversation, but what I wanted to jump in with was that I don't think you're engaging with the idea on the basis that either because of a misunderstanding of it or something, you think that it is claiming that there's some problem that there isn't. What he's saying is not, well, here's this objection, it's a priori, it's deductive, therefore no experimentation needed, natural selection doesn't exist. That's not what he's saying. What he's saying, if I'm understanding this correctly, and I'll let him speak for himself in a moment, is that there is this way in which the current model for natural selection is failing our ability to make these a priori judgments about, you know, causal relationships between phenotypic traits or genotypic traits and the observed, you know, pressure from natural selection, selectivity, whatever. And because of that, we might want to give some thought about how we can retool the model of natural selection or come up with an entirely different model in order to have that explanatory power, because in so many other areas of science, that explanatory power is massively beneficial.
Exactly.
Now, one of the things that admittedly makes this conversation different in the realm of evolutionary biology than any other field is that evolutionary biology is a field in which experimentation is very rare and often not possible. So this is one particular example of a field where actually fitment of a model to an observed set of data is the priority over simply the development of a model off of observed data and then testing and experimentation because of the time scale of evolution.
That very last part, I didn't quite catch because my computer did a glitch on me and I was fixing something. But because of the time scale of evolution, what was the issue there?
Basically, what I'm saying is, if take an example of another field like particle physics, right? Physics, aside from the red tape of how long it takes to get a new kind of particle accelerator built, you know, if you've already got the machinery, there is relatively comparatively little time between the theoretical physicist saying, "Hey, our models have predicted this, or we have this new model that predicts this and we want to test this thing," so we get to do experimentation. Because of the nature of the evolutionary biology being a less experimentable kind of science, that doesn't mean that experiments don't happen in evolutionary biology. Of course they do, but largely evolutionary biology is, you know, not separate from other sciences in terms of like that there's something fundamentally ontologically different about it, but just in practice, evolutionary biology is far more rooted in the kind of theorizing and philosophizing and model building side of the science, as opposed to the practical applied experimental side of the science, because of that time scale of the fact that evolution happens over, you know, millions of years.
Yeah, that makes sense. So to address what you were talking about, I directly asked Carl about this. I was like, so what is the point of bringing this up? And on the one hand, I heard, it sounded like you said that there, like, is no point, but then later you were like, well, no, it's to, like, be able to do new and better science. And so...
Well, one, I brought it up.
That was kind of when
there's a lot of reasons why to bring it up. I mean, one, I think that just talking about this stuff is interesting and fun, right? Just by itself. I don't think gods exist, but I like talking with Christians and theists about their belief. Right, I don't think that really impacts me or changes me in any way, but it's fun the same way that I like playing video games or whatever. Right, it's just a fun thing to do. I think that's enough. But there's more. I'm concerned about the kind of intersection of science and philosophy. I think there are really like, I think the kind of sci bros that have this disdain towards philosophy have a rightful disdain towards philosophy and the lack of consensus. And I think that Phil bros, right, have rightful disdain towards scientific inquiry and the lack to kind of work, right? I kind of want a road that meets together. I think Fodor's argument is a great example of scientific inquiry that's unwilling to understand the philosophical objection. I've yet to talk with, like, the only person I've talked with that's given me decent consideration and took time to understand the argument before responding was Forrest Falkai, which I spent a weekend with in person. And we had great conversations about it, really good conversations. But apart from that, I've yet to have, like, anybody that, like, takes the, like, even remotely seems like they, you know, I don't, what is this intentional stuff? What is this extensional context? I want to understand it. It's always this is a philosophical language game. Well, that's not an objection, right? Maybe it is. But unless you can tell me what intentional means, what extensional means, and then go, hey, this is the problem with that. Look, Mike, I understand what that means. Here's the problem with it. It's hard for me or anyone else to take the objection seriously because it doesn't even seem like it's being engaged with, right?
So,
and I'm just, all I'm pointing out is the purpose of this is that I think that this is a serious objection. There could be issues with it, right? But we can't know what the issues are unless people seriously engage with the objection.
And out of curiosity.
If you wanted to, by the way, if you wanted a Jordan Peterson monologue, I could just go, well, you know what you need to do is have the axiomatic substrates of an archetypal narrative. Sorry. Go ahead.
Well, it depends on what you mean by selection.
By what, you know?
Because it happened in a meta sense. You know?
Well, you know,
and that's where the goddamn truth lies. Because, you know,
but
it's like, yeah, man, that's
what?
Real.
God,
lobsters,
modern neo-Marxists.
So basically, like, what I'm hearing,
I think we can all agree,
like,
Jordan Peterson fucking sucks, but we can move.
Yeah,
from
that
there.
Dude sucks.
Yeah, but like what I'm hearing, Carl. Granted, like, I'll be honest. Like, once you guys got really into, like, the philosophical stuff, my brain turned off because, like, there's a bunch of, like, terms that I just didn't know, and I'm like, okay, well, I'm lost. That's why I didn't interject in a long time. But what I'm gathering now is that there's a philosophical problem with the notion of natural selection, that it doesn't pertain to, like, what it's supposed to be doing in terms of, like, what science says it's supposed to be doing.
Yeah, it's supposed to be able to disambiguate between phenotypic traits, but
right.
In the cases where there are ride-alongs,
right.
Since it's a causal mechanism, you can swap out the ride-along,
right.
And you can say that ride-along was selected for and tell the exact same story.
Right.
And that's not explaining anything.
Not the exact same story.
No, you can. The counterfactual is the exact same. Because what comes along with the... Yeah, because what comes along with the ride-along is the reproductive success. You get the reproductive success if you get that ride-along. Right?
Yes.
And where you get
No, not necessarily.
And you agree, like,
so,
the pumping of the
again,
heart.
Again, this is a... Yeah, again, but
this is
another hypothetical
that
doesn't work in the real world.
History of the world. We look at populations and we observe that, like, functional hearts, right? We look at functional anatomy and we make assessments. We understand that functional anatomy, like hearts, lead to reproductive success. There is no need of natural selection to understand that having a heart versus not having a heart leads to reproductive success. You don't need the theory to invoke that.
When you say ride-alongs, out of curiosity, and I'm asking this because, again, I'm unfamiliar with this argument. I've got some tabs pulled up, and I'll read into this more later. But when you say ride-along traits, are you defining ride-along as a trait that rides along, like a phenotypical trait that rides along with another phenotypical trait because of a genotypical change or mutation in one particular instance or example of a mutation? Or are you referring to ride-alongs as things that always occur together?
Yeah, like where you get T1, you get T2, and where you get T2, you get T1.
Okay, so for in like a Lewisian kind of way, that there is no possible world where you get T1 but not T2.
Exactly.
Okay. Fair
enough. Those are the only things of interest.
So those again,
there's not a problem.
So I think one of the problems is what I've been trying to do is not. I have not been trying to tackle the argument from, like, the point of these definitions of intentionality versus extensionality or whatever it is. What I'm doing is you're saying, because I'm not good at that, and that maybe I should have said that early on, and I think a lot of people can get it. But what I have been trying to do is, you've been telling me that natural selection can't do these things or can't explain these things, and I pretty much this whole time have been trying to tell you like what natural selection actually can describe and what it can do. So for example, with this free rider thing, again, your examples are just hypotheticals, and I don't think that they actually comport with anything in reality, because what does a free rider look like in reality? This is why I talked about linked traits.
Wait, so you when don't you think said that science uses you got counterfactuals?
No, you got to let me do this. Okay. When you said that you can't get the free rider basically is always there. No, that's not how linked traits work. And again, the trait that may seem irrelevant, like if I have blank, if you have high immunity toward some disease, you'll also have green eyes or whatever. There's a high correlation between those two things. That may be because the locus of where those genes are located is really close on the chromosome, but so selecting for that green eye can explain why the person has a very high probability of being immune to that disease, but it's not every single time. So like when you couched it that way, that isn't true.
I'm not understanding, because like the point is that like one, hypotheticals, like I can give you, I've tried to give you real examples, but even if not, we use counterfactuals, right? And some people might say like, well, why should we talk about things that are counter to fact? Like that seems unnecessary. Well, that's what we do. If X is the case, we should expect Y, right? Like say if I stepped off the curb, then I would have got hit by the car. We could go observe like, you know, at 2 p.m. when I was supposed to step off the curb, like what was the traffic like? What, you know, was there buses? Was there a bus route? Was there high traffic? Was there speeding cars, right? Things like that. And we could assess the counterfactual. These things do matter, because when we go for an explanatory thesis, we want to be able to explain what is expected. We want to be able to explain, you know, if X, you know, we should expect Y. It's not the case, we should expect, you know, not Y, right? We want these types of expectations. But when it turns out that the view is something like a buy low, sell high, this is essentially what I'm charging natural selection to be. It's a trivial explanation. It's like me telling you in the stock market, when you want to play it, I just say, oh, buy low, sell high. That will explain every dollar that you make and every dollar that you lose. But it doesn't explain what stocks you should buy. It doesn't give you any novel predictions on, you know, what the corporate ladder might be like, right? There's no predictive success there. And what I'm charging is that natural selection is no more, no less than some buy low, sell high principle that, sure, it explains, you know, in some trivial sense why phenotypic traits lead to fixation, but it doesn't explain, like, you know, why some phenotypic trait rather than another will. It doesn't explain that some deco-founding phenotypic trait leads to succession rather than another, because I can just use the counterfactual support to talk about thumping of a heart rather than pumping of a heart, and I get the same reproductive success, right? That's a selection of two traits.
To actually rule that out, you'd have to come
for a phenotypic trait.
Yeah, but to actually rule that out, you'd have to produce hearts that do thump and hearts that don't thump to gauge whether or not thumping has anything to do with has any actual survival.
No. Whatever. That's the part that I'm conceding. I'm saying me and you can look in the world and we could deco-found the variables and just go, yeah, I mean, obviously, if there was just the thumping sounds, like those things aren't going to survive. It's the pumping of the blood. That's precisely what I'm saying, that we don't invoke the theory. We can look into the world and just know through functional anatomy and through any other statistical means of like looking at populations, that things with those with, you know, this organ or, you know, lacking that will have a higher chance of reproduction. That doesn't take anything more than some statistical analysis about populations. It doesn't take some theory to invoke what phenotypic trait is actually selected for. That's what natural selection is purporting to do. But like, given that, you know, we like have hearts that come along with this phenotypic trait of thumping, and I can tell you the same story in all of these cases, why is it not the case that I can just say what was selected for was the thump thump sounds? Because I get the same fixation of the phenotypic trait that leads to fixation, right? Me and you can obviously tell it's the pumping and not the thumping, but natural selection tells us nothing about that. It can't deconfound those things. We know that by just natural history and functional anatomy. Optimal foraging and rates and things like that.
I'm gonna shoot in the opposite direction now, because this is just, again, and this is with the understanding.
If traits aren't selected for Robert, then you can see the argument.
Could it not then be said that natural selection is, in reality, it's a more complex framework than simply the notion that this correlation and therefore this ride along is sufficient, but that our full model of natural selection is one where, yes, you have this precedent of a change in genotype begetting a change in phenotype, which is, you know, leading to some sort of fixation of trait, but that we then apply additional, you know, factual information, knowledge of anatomy, of the historicity of a species, of whatever, in order to confirm and like debate the validity of some particular agent. In other words, like, very rare in science do we consider, you know, like a particular model to not, you know, be interoperable with other models. So if natural selection is a model for describing behavior in the real world, we would expect that it also both plays well and transfers information to and from other models, which when combined with it provides additional explanatory power for one particular trait. And it's, you know, like you said, it's truth value in terms of, I guess, the, if you want to be crude, like the truth maker, truth bearer argument.
Yeah, but like, I think we do get, so like, you tell me if I'm, because I just want to make sure I'm not just ignoring what you're saying. I think that we're getting this predictive success. What we're doing is invoking things like optimal foraging rates and predator-prey ratios, right? These types of statistical analysis. Do you think that those, like, right, those things don't invoke any theory of natural selection in order for us to assess the data? Like, do you think that they do?
Oh, I see what you're saying. So, no, I see what you're saying. You're making the claim that, in other words, natural selection is superfluous to these deeper things which we are actually using.
Yeah, I'm saying biologists are smarter than the theory they think they're invoking. Look, we can go out to a population. I can tell you that the population with longer necks are more likely to survive. my grandmother can tell you that. I don't understand, like, why I have to invoke some trait. Like, how is natural selection predicting that phenotypic trait? Right, like, I'm not understanding how that isn't just an aspect of natural history and functional anatomy and understanding there, right? Just observing the world that invokes no latent theory.
Part of this is that sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just gonna say, Peterson, Simon's in the chat.
He hasn't requested yet. I saw your little back and forth.
Yeah, I was just trying. I'm trying to be quiet because I don't want to take over the live, and I feel like I'm a little out of my league at this point.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Also, let me know if I am yapping and need to make space for somebody else to join the conversation. I'm happy to bail out, and I appreciate you bringing me up. One other particular charge that I would say is that maybe I'm trying to think of what the right way to phrase this is. So one of the things that, based on my understanding, is that, you know, this theory of natural selection that we have, and okay, hold on. I want to be clear here. We are disambiguating between natural selection as like a driving engine behind evolution, not simply the propagation of traits spreading throughout a species. But I mean, natural selection.
Yeah, if it's just some description, that's not really like informative. It's supposed to be, from my understanding, some explanatory thesis or some mechanism, right? But like, if it's some mechanism and it's a causal mechanism, the issue is that it's an extensional. Like, so you said you like philosophy, so you're familiar with like extensional and intentional contexts. So like, So like Lois Lane, or I'm sorry, Clark Kent is Superman, right? That's a true proposition, right? And we take the proposition, Superman can fly. Now we can swap out the coextensive or the co-referential term. Superman and Clark Kent with each other, and we preserve the truth value, right?
Right.
Some extensional context. Now think about that in a causal mechanistic sense. Think about like some dodgy wire in the attic.
If you were to swap, like, right. Then you can swap, like, you gave the analogy of smoke,
the fire and the smoke. Yeah.
Right, but in the case of evolution, if you're looking at a ride-along trait, then you're not preserving that. The thing
we're talking about an intentional. We're talking about an intentional context. If I swap the two ride-along traits, the two co-extensional traits, I risk preserving the truth value in the same way that when we say Lois Lane believes that Superman can fly and I swap out Superman with Clark Kent, we risk preserving the truth value, right? So, for example, it's not going to preserve the truth value if I say what was selected for was camouflaging into its environment, and I swap out the polar bear camouflaging into its environment with the polar bear was had selection for its whiteness. That won't preserve truth value.
The problem that I have here is, and I'm not laying that this is the case, but it's something that I'm not immediately able to distinguish. But I worry that arguments like these can be very prone to a problem where what we're doing is essentially like a lexical shuffle as opposed to an actual like transmutation of a proposition. So in the cases that you're giving, and I totally
but
accept
these, but,
that, like,
but the point is that they have reference, and the reference changed the value of the proposition being true. And that's not an objection to any other referent that changes any other language statement that we have. That's why I don't find this like language argument to be like, because then you're gonna have to, by parity of reasoning, also suggest that when statements or words refer to things in the world that makes those statements true, that like that there's also the same language game going on. But then how is scientific inquiry possible? How is inductive skepticism not inevitable?
I wasn't alleging that is happening. I was saying that I was not confident that it wasn't. In other words, I had not assessed it for that yet.
Well, I'm just saying like that move gets frustrating because then equally like, okay, don't stop there. Like, don't do this taxi cab thing where you get in the taxi cab and then just get out when you want. Take it all the way to your destination, because I promise it's not favorable for you on your own positions, right? I will invoke a tu quoque and pull you down with me, because I know that like the point being, you should have never made that, you know, language move in the first place, because then if you want to make that move, then great. Then we'll take true propositions that you use words for that have reference to those words, and I'll throw the same.
No, hold on. Sorry, that's not the case. That's not the case I was alleging. I wasn't saying that happens in every case. I'm saying sometimes when we make arguments like this, by no directional or intentional fault, we're using language that is implying a sort of semantic relationship that doesn't exist in the actual propositions themselves because of the nuances of language. Again, I'm not alleging that that's something you did intentionally. I'm also not even saying that's something I think happened here. I was, as a preface to a separate thought, saying that I don't.
Yeah,
know.
Yeah,
that
sorry, I'm not trying happening. To charge you with that. I'm sorry.
So,
yeah.
Cole, I agree with you, and like this is one of the other main problems I'm having, like, because it's not the traits, it's the genes. Like you were talking about camouflage or whatever, right? So the statement animals pass down camouflage to their offspring is false. That's not how it works. So when you couch your argument, I feel like a huge amount of the argument,
no one's denying that the genotypic, like, you know, priority. No one's denying that. It's not like I divorce it from the genotypic priority. That'd be insane.
But you only talk about it in those terms.
That doesn't resolve the problem. So let me ask you, Peterson, when you invoke the genes or the genotype or whatever, how do you think that absolves the extensional intentional context?
I'll read you my bullet points when I looked into this. This was many months ago. And like I said, I'd have to sit down and think about this for a long time. You snuck up on me. I'm not accusing you of anything. I'm just saying this is a complex topic, right? But these are the notes.
Yeah,
these are the notes I took. Okay, and they're in bullets, so hopefully I'll remember how to connect these all together. So just listen to this, and you can tell me what you think about it.
No, you've been a really good sport. I'm not trying to. Yeah, I'm not. Yeah, no, you're great.
Okay, so this is what I wrote down. Natural selection doesn't select traits; it selects genes. So, for example, hemoglobin. Heme is selected, but not red. There is no law that selects heme. That this is something that Fodor actually brought up. So when Jerry says things like, there is no law that selects heme, and there are no laws for selection of any trait, he fundamentally misunderstands what's actually happening during evolution. Of course, there's no law that selects heme. Evolution is really chemical evolution. A bird does not pass down a beak. If that were the case, then Lamarckian evolution would be true. Organisms pass down genes that control for traits. And I brought up Richard Dawkins and the selfish gene earlier. That was the big revolution. What did I write down next?
So it's worth noting in response to that, because I think that this is an example of you and Carl speaking past each other. You are both in agreement that what is actually being passed down is genes, and that phenotype is encoded in genotype. The argument that's being made, though, is that natural selection, because that is where essentially the metal meets the road, the actual traits meet the real world. It's the material manifestation of the trait, the phenotype, where the actual pressure is applied. Then and only then is essentially the trait preserved through the expression of that trait down in the genotype. He's not saying that genes aren't how they're passed along. That's not even what Fodor thinks. The argument that he's making is that because that's where the actual pressure is, the environmental pressure, where it will manifest in more reproduction. I mean, and you can literally just Google, does natural selection act on phenotype or genotype? And every resource that I've just pulled
up
is in agreement. It'll say phenotype.
In every case. But which is fine. Like, I want to go, like, if somebody has a different view, then, you know, they're free to make a different case. And then, by the way, the argument wouldn't apply to them because, you know, maybe they just, you know, make some other case, you know.
But by the way,
which would just not apply to this argument.
There's a trivially easy way to verify this, and that's simply that because genetic code often contains information which is essentially a kind of like a Hamming encoding or like a, you know, parity information to protect against mutation errors, you can verify just through thinking that this is the case because, you know, if a mutation within an organism causes a genotypical change, but it doesn't cause a phenotypical change, then even if it's passed on to its offspring, like the thing which we care about, the actual trait which is going to apply the selective pressure, won't have been invoked, and that's not really considered natural selection.
Exactly. So one thing too is that Fodor and people that like myself that run the argument, we agree there is a fact of the matter that there is a phenotypic trait that leads to fixation of population. Right. But like one of the issues is that in like artificial selection, it's really easy for us to tell what is selected for because there's a mind, there's a belief state, there's like some intention. Like, you know, let's say Cole wants to breed dogs and wants short haired dogs, or he wants brown dogs. Right. And he's breeding dogs and they're long haired dogs and there's short-haired dogs and they're brown, and I'm like, hey, you know, man, you got a bunch of long-haired dogs, like, you know, is that a problem? And he's like, no, I don't care about that. I'm like, why don't you care? And he just tells me his intention. He's like, well, I'm selecting for brown dogs. I don't care about this ride-along trait that they happen to come short-haired or they happen to come long-haired. All I care about selecting for with my business are brown dogs. I'm in the brown dog business. And we get inscribing that intention there is great. But what we don't want to do in science is allow for this possibility for creationists.
So people
to give non-scientific explanations that what drives evolution is this mind, right? We want to avoid that, right? But the problem is that we are not getting that when we use the causal explanation. We're having this issue with the extensional context. And that's going to be a problem. So when you gave the Fodor quote, and he's talking about the chemical analysis, what I worry is that what he's doing there, because I'm not familiar with that quote, I have to read it, is that he's giving what he thinks is the story, that the solution is not invoking a mind, but like natural laws, right? But then you lose out on a biological story. That's his point, that we can describe these things at the level of chemistry or even further at the level of physics, but the point is that you lose out, right, on your biological explanation, on your biological theory, and you're just giving a physical theory. Right, which is what I'm conceding the thing is that, you know, maybe there's some, you know, law of nature or something.
Well,
but it can't be a biological story.
When I had this conversation with Danny, we kind of ended up at this point where we're like, well, if it's just it was sort of like, well, then natural selection isn't a real thing, because if it's all just happening at the level of the gene or whatever, or chemicals, then whatever, whatever. And then we kind of got to this point where I was like, well, I mean, yeah, but if that's the case, then like there is no biology, there is no biological law, it's just chemistry, and the chemistry is just physics. And he proposed that to be a problem. But I was like, I don't really think, like, maybe you could say it's a problem, but I don't think it's a problem worth deliberating about, because then we have to throw our hands up and say, well, there's no such thing as weather, like cold fronts and warm fronts, those don't create tornadoes, because there's no such thing as a cold front. They're just molecules with different amounts of energy, less energy, kinetic energy, than what we call a warm front. And it's like, okay, you know what? I literally agree that the standard model are the only things that actually exist, but nobody actually navigates the world that way. So then I was like, well, then what's the point of bringing that?
We lose out on the bridge laws, right? Like, we have bridge, like, you can't use certain language of physics to talk about certain language of chemistry and certain language of biology. It just doesn't translate well. We have things like bridge laws, right? Yes. But then you miss out on that. So now you're just saying, we don't have any biological story, and thus we don't have any bridge laws from the physical story to the biological story. That's fine. That's what I think's going on. But the problem there is that we give up on the biological thesis, and it's concession to the argument. Now, if we want to use this, like I'm a meteorological nihilist, so I don't think that there are objects with proper parts, right? I think we're just talking about...
Dude, that's awesome, because I'm a meteorological universalist.
Oh, you are? Yeah. So
I'm
like,
a level
yeah,
54
okay, that's
barbarian.
Well, so, like, I just think that, like, particles, like, you know, rearrange, right? I don't think that, like there's the ontology of a table that has a proper part or something like that. I think that's just, like, what we do, you know, with language in our head. Really, there's,
right,
like, these
particles. I would make the exact same argument as a meteorological universalist. I'd say every possible collection of symbols counts as an object. The only difference is that we attach semantic and linguistic importance to certain concepts because they're useful to talk about.
Oh, so damn, me and you would have a really good conversation on that. But I mean,
this reminds me of the theme song to Danny Phantom. His molecules got all rearranged. Gotta catch them all because he's a damn. Okay, I want to make sure we don't go down that road, though. Simon, what's up?
I actually don't want to go down that road. The reason only I bring it up is that, like, I don't have a problem with kind of like what you're saying in that sense, that if we embrace like the view that I'm saying, like, that kind of falls out for free because, like, when we talk about it, there isn't, like, you know, really there isn't biological functions. This is just a neat way for us to talk about, like, this collective of, you know, particles that we see from our perspective. If we're some bird, you know, floating over some, like, football stadium, then, like, obviously the band members that are making shapes, we wouldn't say that, like, oh, the letter S is, like, a real object. Like, no, like, it doesn't matter if, like, the trillionth band member comes in there. Like, it's just, like, particles that are forming in some shape, right? And that's my view, and I think that's completely compatible with what's going on in the world. But when we want to tell some story, like, you know, there's this ontology of the phenotype that's being selected for and stuff, like, there's a problem there because you're making these kind of commitments on the biological level that I just think causes a lot of problems. But anyway,
I gotta bail out here. I appreciate you guys letting me in. This has been a super interesting conversation. I gotta go. I appreciate it, Carl. I'm gonna follow you. You should jump in my Discord server. I'd love to talk meteorology sometimes. Thanks, Peterson, for having me up. I've appreciated it.
You're welcome.
Yeah, I gave you a follow. Yeah, I'm gonna bounce too. I mean,
Carl, I've been dying to ask you a question for clarification for, like, the longest time.
Oh, sure.
If you have a minute. Like, maybe I'm just a dumbass. I don't know. But if we can do the deconfounding experiment in a petri dish, if I can take what I believe to be naturally selected, why a trait exploded to a disproportionate outsized representation of the population, and move it into a controlled environment and watch the exact same thing take place, what is the issue?
The issue is when you're talking about deconfounding ride-along traits. Right, it's easy to deconfound, like,
okay, sure,
variables.
But
like,
I don't.
But I can deconfound the ice and the whiskey,
Carl,
to tell what's getting me
one
drunk.
Moment. One biological nuance is that in a population with genetic variants, there is no guarantee that they all will have the same ride-alongs. In a petri dish of bacteria, they can absolutely have enough variation between them, yet the causal transplant in one population does the same thing no matter what variation you put it with.
Yeah, but look, I'm talking about like a specific case where, like, so you would agree that there are cases where you have some phenotypic trait that's selected for and that there are ride-along traits that come along with that trait.
Sure,
right?
Like a whole genome. You can insert we can insert one gene into a bacterial genome and do that experiment irrelevant of what the rest of the bacterial genome is.
And yeah, but what I care about is what phenotype is being selected for.
I have controlled for all of your ride-alongs.
Yeah, but look, what I care about is what phenotypic trait is selected for. And if the issue is an a priori, like, there's not, the issue isn't going to be you going in the lab and solving this issue, which I wish was the case, right? Because, like, I care more about science than I do philosophy.
I feel like we have. Is that an oversight from philosophers that they think we haven't? I don't.
Well, what is it that you think you've done?
So, I mean, it's super easy. Undergrads learn it in their biology class, how to clone genes into other organisms, right? That's
yeah, but I'm not talking about organisms. That. I'm talking about phenotypic traits that are
right.
selected
we can,
for.
We can, yes, and we agree that phenotypes are underwritten by genes.
Yeah, but...
Right?
But
when I say I transplant a gene for a more efficient receptor binding into a particular bacteria for its host or whatever, like... We can clearly rationalize that a more efficient binding might increase its infectivity rate, and that is why we see it survive. That's just the rationale. So we can run that experiment. We can clone that.
But this isn't an a posteriori objection.
A population and watch it take over the whole petri dish.
Like, yeah, but look, if okay, so this is the issue. The issue is not like. Because it's not clear to me that you're understanding what Fodor's objection is by that response. So, like, I don't know if I should...
came in with that. So, like, maybe I'm not. But, like, we can control for...
Well, let me at least, like, explain why I think...
We absolutely can control
for... I feel like Simon's doing what I was doing, and then you're giving the same response. You're saying it's dead on arrival because...
I'm not saying it. Look, just tell me what Fodor's objection is so that it's clear to me that you understand what it is, right? I think that's a fair response for me to ask you, because sure, otherwise you're objecting to something you don't know what you're talking, like, in terms of, it's not like, obviously, Simon, I've been on lives with you talking with creationists and telling them that they just are wrong about their beliefs, right? I'm J Mike.
Right. I'm not coming at this like I think you're... You think evolution or whatnot is bullshit.
No, evolution is 100% true.
I'm trying not to put words in your mouth. I know where you're coming from. My whole thing is this idea that we can't sufficiently deconfound natural selection and watch it recapitulate in front of our eyes. Like,
yeah, but do you understand why we can't, like, in principle, why, like, it's an in principle argument. Do you understand why I'm saying in principle we can't?
If I can show you that we literally can, I then the principle doesn't stand.
Yeah, but do you know what the in principle objection that I'm making is? Because, like, otherwise, whatever you're, I don't know, like, what it, like, you could just be showing me a banana, but, like, how, why would that be relevant? Like, It's important for me to know that what it is that you're showing me as a response to what you think I'm saying.
Right. So my understanding, right? I came in with this. Maybe I don't understand the argument. My understanding is that we cannot sufficiently say that natural selection is moving traits to fixation, because at any time, any instance, example that we see that we might explain invoke natural selection, we also see a bunch of confounding variables in the genome as well. That trait moving to fixation is pulling with it a whole genome worth of other things.
Yeah, the selective sweep, I get that. Like, you're talking about something like selective sweep, but, like, that doesn't absolve any issue. Like, Like, I can concede something like selective sweep, pulling along these genes. I don't have any problem with that, right? I'm 100% on board with that. I'm on board with, like, considerations of pleiotropy, right? All that stuff is, like, I think 100%, you know, grade A, awesome, great stuff. But the problem is when we point out we have an organism where it's purported to have some selected trait for some phenotype, where there's a ride along. And the issue in principle is that causal mechanisms, right? Something like A causes B, right, is an extensional context where when we have something that, like, you know, the dodgy wire causing the fire, and I replace fire with smoke because those two things are coextensive with each other, that I preserve truth value. Causal mechanisms will preserve the truth value. If it causes A and what comes along with A is B, then it also causes B, right? You can think of it as like transitivity, right? It causes A, what comes along with A is B, so it causes B as well, right? Now, the issue though is that when we talk about something like selection for, that is not extensional. That is intentional with an S, not with a T. Like, not intentional, you know, T-I-O-N-S or T-I-O-N, but S-I-O-N, intentional, right? The issue there is that when we have traits like what is selected for is the camouflaging into its environment or its whiteness, or what's selected for is frogs snapping at flies versus ambient black dots, that you couldn't transfer those to phenotypic traits and preserve the truth value. Natural selection is telling us a story that one of those phenotypic traits was selected for. But if it turns out that it was selected of those two traits, it's not doing what it purported to do in principle. And it can't in principle because the selection for is in an intentional context and the causal mechanism is an extensional context.
So here's my question then. Those two phenotypes, we can just agree are genes. There's a gene for camouflage in that instance. What we're talking about, natural selection, this taking over of the population, this moving to fixation, this trait exploding in representation in the population, that's what we're calling natural selection, that we're not talking past each other?
I think we are. My understanding is that we're talking about selection for process that leads a phenotypic trait to fixation in a population.
But that's what we see in natural selection, right? If a trait is, when we invoke natural selection, we're saying that a trait, its gene, is propagating in the population. At first, a few individuals had it, and now more and more and more.
When we're talking about natural selection, we're talking about selective pressures on the phenotype. That's uncontroversial.
Right, and you're just kicking the can down the road. I've told Peterson is underwritten by genes.
I get that, but so I'll ask the same question. Invoking the genotype or genes, what do you think that does to solve the problem?
What it does is that free rider trait
and the gene.
No, you get the same phenotypic trait. What are you talking about?
No, Carl. The thing you were talking about with the free rider trait.
Those genes all of a sudden erases the ride along phenotypic trait? It doesn't.
Yes.
In a situation where that trait comes along, the genotype is the same.
No.
It's the same.
No. Deconfounding experiments. We move a phenotype into another more controlled organism, controlling for all the ride alongs that you would invoke. We can transplant a phenotype by transplanting a gene and watch it move to fixation in a population in front of our eyes.
Okay, so you.
But also, Carl, like, do you know about gene linkage?
Look, okay, none of this matters to whether or not.
It absolutely does.
Okay, I understand gene linkage.
Okay.
Do you think that if I did or I didn't, that somehow changes an extensional context of causal mechanisms versus the intentional context of selection for?
Because
that's what I'm. Look, if I'm, you, now I'm starting to get slightly words. Irritated because I what I want is an actual response to what I'm saying, not talking about empirical observations that aren't engaging with an a priori objection that an extensional causal mechanism is incompatible with the notion that selection for being an intentional context, right? That's the issue.
You keep telling us, though, that the problem is that selection, natural selection, can't distinguish between the favorable trait that we want and some trait that is a ride along that simply comes with it. And it can, because again, that's just a hypothetical, but we can look at real world examples of this. And like, for example, linked traits, like you remember my immune to a disease and you don't have fingerprints analogy?
Yeah, but again, okay. all of this is avoiding the a priori.
No,
objection.
It's not. So, ahead. Do you remember my example?
Yeah, you link some genes together that say nothing about the selection for process being incompatible.
Yes, they do. So we can say that not having fingerprints informs you. It is a good predictor of whether or not you're immune to this disease, but that's not but we don't have a confounding variable here. It's not that, well, we can't tell if it's the fingerprint or something else. They come together very often because they are highly linked, but they can be separated. So you can separate out what looks like a free rider from the other actual trait. And Simon's telling you, yes, we can actually isolate those things and get rid of this free rider problem.
Saying we can get rid of the free rider problem just in itself is begging the question against the argument that I'm running, right? The argument that I'm running is that there's an extensional context, which is a causal mechanism. Do we disagree that when there's a causal mechanism that A causes B, and then B.
Yeah, and you're saying we can't tell if it's the free rider or the other thing, and we just gave you examples of how you can determine that.
I'm gonna run through the propositions and let's see what we accept and what we don't accept, right? Because this will just make it so much easier for me. We agree that when A causes B and B comes along with C in that case, that A caused C. Do we agree with that?
Sure.
Great. Do we agree that when we talk about a context which is a selection for A, right, not of A, or I'm sorry, selection for B in this case, not selection of B and C, that it was selected for B and not for C?
Sure.
Great. And do we agree that natural selection is a selection process that's a selection for or a selection against process?
Sure.
A lot of people think
that causal mechanisms are the one that I described initially, that they preserve the causal relation, that C will be
what caused. I'm saying, but my...
Hold on. Do we agree with that?
In actual biology...
No, hold on. But do we agree with that? This was the last thing I just wanted an acceptance on. Do we agree? It's honestly just getting a re-agreement. You agree now that causal mechanisms, right, when we talk about A causing B, that it causes C and that preserves the truth value, right? If I say that the dodgy wire caused the fire and I change it with smoke, we preserve truth value, assuming that the fire caused the smoke.
Sure.
Great. Yeah. So then you concede the argument that in principle, a selection for process is not extensional and can't do what, or I'm sorry, if selection for process is intentional and can't do what it purports to do. Right. That just falls out of accepting those things. You accept the incongruence of a causal mechanism and selection for also being a causal mechanism, but then you also accept incongruent or in conjunction with that, that it's an intentional context, that when we swap out these co-extensional traits that we can't preserve the truth value. You can't have it both ways. That's the problem.
We can clear C from the board. Like, we can know that A caused B. It just B. Like, in biology, we don't need a C. We can control for C.
The problem, if I drink a glass of whiskey, we can deconfound the variables. I can take the ice out, I can take the whiskey out. I can eat the ice and go, I didn't get drunk. So that doesn't explain my drunkenness. I can drink just the whiskey, and that explains my drunkenness, right? But when we talk about natural selection on this intentional context, where it's supposed to select for, but it's some causal mechanism, then we can't decofound the variables.
But we literally can, though. I don't.
Yeah, we.
This is where
we,
this is
we know
where
what
I'm,
genes.
I'm struggling.
We know how to do gene linkage, and we can isolate things in the lab. And you just keep telling us that's not a solution. And I don't get why it's not a solution. And I don't want to do this.
I've said it six times. What does intentional mean, and what does extensional mean?
I don't want to.
If we don't, if we don't have an understanding of this, I can't take your objection seriously.
I really am. I'm not trying to be a dick here. I really feel like maybe I don't think I'm misunderstanding your argument. Can you paraphrase what I am saying?
If you're not, this is not. You don't get to just look. You don't just declare
when I'm
using specific language, and I'm asking
page.
You if you understand
do
it. You don't
that,
get to just reverse on
you, man. I'm just trying to make sure that you have clarity on what I think is my objection. Can you give me that courtesy?
Your objection is yes, we can decofound the variables that are selected for. But that's what I anticipate somebody who disagrees with the argument to say. That isn't actually engaging with the a priori objection. This
but
isn't
when we
some, like the objection
the same
isn't something that is
take place deconfounding all the variables when we still see natural selection void of co-riding traits. Like what does that tell us? What does that
look telling me that you can decofound certain traits is not addressing the problem. The problem is in the cases where we have ride along traits, right? Where you get that trait, you also get the other trait. In principle, you can't. There's no selection for. By the way, because there's a causal process at which we can swap out the traits that are selected of, and we get the exact same counterfactual support. I can say that the thumping of the heart that was selected for is going to lead to a phenotypic trait.
Yes, I've heard this example four times.
I don't know why I keep getting interrupted.
Genetically, we can often separate the thumping and the pumping.
You've been doing it the whole time, J-Mike. J-Mike, you
keep... I waited for his entire explanation.
You keep telling us that, well, you keep giving us the reason why this is a problem because it can't explain blank, and then we give you examples of how it explains blank, and then you go, wait, do you actually know what intentionality versus extensionality means?
And then still want to deny it, right? That's the absurdity that we're at so far. I gave you propositions. You accepted all of them and somehow still want to reject it.
What I'm saying is, yes, I can agree with your argument, but I don't think it holds true as some like...
If you agree with the argument, then I'm done here. The debate is over.
Traits aren't linked all the time.
If you agree with the argument, the debate is over, Simon.
We can unlink them.
Simon, the debate is over if you agree with the argument.
In the cases where traits are always, in the hypothetical that traits are always and there is no way to unlink them, then sure, yes, have a field day. But that's not reality, though.
Okay, look, I don't know. All that just sounded like nonsense. I don't understand what that.
Oh, welcome to our world.
So it's nonsense to you. If it's nonsense to you, then why have you not made an effort to tell me what you think extensional and intentional means after the fifth time of explaining it to you? And what I am Steelman, my issue. Because I guarantee not one of you can do it.
I feel like I did.
You keep telling
me. Steelman it right now. I'll mute my mic and you go ahead and you Steelman it. And don't just go, can't deconfound the variables. Explain what I mean when I give the intentional and extensional context. That's a crux to the argument.
Well, what I've been doing this whole time is...
If you ever read Fodor's book, you would understand that's the point of the argument. Which, by the way...
So
go ahead and Steelman the argument.
I feel like I have given the argument to try.
It's not clear to me that you have, so do it again. Maybe I have like hearing issues. Go ahead and do it again.
The whole proposition is that we can't invoke natural selection as a selection for specific traits because in every instance there are these ride-along traits, and we don't know.
You're
what
already
is
wrong.
Okay, then. There.
I didn't say in every instance.
That's the exact same.
I was actually very specific that it's not in every instance. It's very clear that there are phenotypic traits that lead to fixation of population of which don't have ride-alongs. That would be dumb, right? And also, I don't think that it's not the case that there isn't a fact of the matter about what phenotypic trait leads to fixation, because even Fodor himself in his book concedes that, and every biologist, for whatever reason that's responded to him, thinks that he's not agreeing to that when he says it like seven times clearly. It just like goes to show that people that are engaged in the scientific literature aren't actually reading and engaging with the philosophical literature, which is so frustrating, because if it's such an easy argument to dismantle, if it's such an easy argument, such an easy language game, then it would be like, you know, maybe one thing to understand the book and use the language that Fodor uses and use the like thesis that he actually presents, which he goes over intentional extensional context like just throughout the entire book to actually engage with that. None of that is what I said. What I said was that there's an intention. Like, so again, that's why I asked you to use the language. Do you know what intentional context means and extensional context means? If you don't, then I'd like, I don't know how many times I have to say it. Like, I can't just tell you seven times and expect you to understand it. I mean, I can only say it and then ask you if you understand it, and we run through it.
Don't you feel like having to explain something several times might be an indication of an inability to communicate an idea?
Okay, so you do you seriously struggle with this? Let's see if you struggle with this.
Let's see if you struggle with this.
In extensional context, let's actually see if you struggle with this. In extensional context. So you believe, like, right, Superman can fly, right? That's part of the story, right?
You're not defining these terms, you're giving examples of them.
If it's the case that Superman can fly and Clark Kent is Superman, we agree on that, then we can swap out Superman and Clark Kent and we can preserve the truth value, right? Clark Kent can fly, right?
You're not actually defining... You told us we can't define these, and you're not defining them. You're giving examples of them.
Extensional context is when you can swap out co-referential terms and preserve the truth value. And I'm giving you an example of that.
Okay.
Okay.
Extensional, the ability to swap out co-referential
terms and preserve the truth value of the proposition, right?
Because, fantastic.
Yeah, because think of it, in the context where Superman can fly and Clark Kent is Superman, we can swap out that and we preserve truth value. But if we specify someone like Lois Lane believes Superman can fly, and we swap out Superman with Clark Kent, that proposition isn't true. There are certain contexts that matter when talking about preserving truth value of propositions. And in this case, the intentional context with an S, intentional, is that when we swap out Clark Kent and Superman when talking about Lois Lane's belief states, it's not true that we preserve the proposition because she doesn't know that Superman is Clark Kent. Now, what I'm saying is that natural selection is that intentional context. It's saying that it can select for one of those things, and if we swap out the ride-along trait, we won't preserve the truth value. The same way that if we swap out Clark Kent and Superman, we won't preserve the truth value. But causal mechanisms are extensional. They're like the context where we swap out Clark Kent and Superman, and it does preserve truth value. And so, in other words, causal mechanisms can't disambiguate between the selective process on what was selected for. In principle, they can't do that.
So, Carl, hold on. Let me do this because I don't want us to get chippy, because I want us to be like on the same side. So, what you said,
I have to get going soon. I said that like 45 minutes
ago. I know.
So,
and we can try to, but you said
we can do a part two. Plan. I mean, you know, I love you.
You said the problem is we can't distinguish between the free rider and the trait in question, right? Isn't that kind of what you just said?
Biologists can. I'm saying natural selection, the theory of natural selection,
right,
can't do anything in the theory to disambiguate between those two. Biologists can't.
Sure.
When Simon does it, he can. He's not invoking natural selection in order to do that.
Okay.
You are smarter than the theory you invoke.
In my petri dish, I am watching natural selection. I'm not doing some genetic. I am literally watching.
What's the prediction? What's the prediction natural selection gives you?
I'm watching a population change because a trait was transplanted into it, and it's now moving to fixation.
What's the prediction? What phenotypic trait leads to fixation under that prediction?
Whatever I think that trait is in that circumstance. I gave
yeah, but
the
you're
example
just, like
of
if it just turns out to be something that leads to reproductive success, we just have some like
exactly
weird
exactly.
Okay, then great. Then it's the same thing I said earlier, that it's just some trivial buy low, sell high principle in economics, right? Just merely like you're not getting that out of any theory. You're just like invoking some functional anatomy, some like natural history of what typically survives and what typically doesn't. You don't need natural selection to invoke that. If you thought that you did, there would be some novel prediction invoked in your theory.
But nature selects which traits get through the environment.
Or better yet, tell me what prediction in natural selection gives that if it hadn't come true would render natural selection false.
Say that again.
Name me a prediction natural selection makes that if it hadn't come true would render natural selection false.
For natural selection.
Yeah, it's unfalsifiable.
I don't think it's necessarily unfalsifiable.
It is.
So like,
there's not a prediction that you will be able to give me that if the theory is true, wouldn't be true under the theory.
So I can think of a lot of things that would disprove evolution, but I've never been asked to come up with something that would disprove natural selection before. I mean, that's interesting. I feel like it would be almost impossible to disentangle just evolution and natural selection in that case. Does that make sense?
I don't know that I understand. Maybe you want to say it again.
Okay. Like I can think of examples, like observations or whatever, that would disprove evolution.
Oh, that's not my issue though. I think evolution is 100%.
Yeah, I know. True. But if it's evolution by natural selection, then to me those are just the same, kind of like the same thing. So I've never been asked to produce something that would disprove natural selection. That's an interesting one.
I don't think that there, like, I mean, I could be proven wrong on this, but I don't think that there is. Like, part of the issue that I think here is that because of this issue, it doesn't even seem like there's like a falsification criterion. All we're doing is merely observing like organisms that have some phenotypic traits that we observe with like functional anatomy, of optimal foraging rates, optimal foraging rates, predator prey ratio.
I mean, if we observed, I feel like if we observed that allele frequencies just never change,
That would disprove evolution. But that's a fact that you would just.
Yeah.
I don't know how anybody could ever look at a population and say there aren't allelic, you know, frequencies.
Yeah, but I'm trying to figure out.
You have like Hardy-Weinberg equations to show you literally how much evolution is occurring in a population, right? Like I concede all of that, but. Maybe this isn't as important of a point, but this, you know, an overarching point is that I don't find this to be a scientific theory. Like what we have with other processes in evolutionary biology, right? Like selective or sexual selection and genetic drift, all these things. I think we can make really good predictions that invoke the content there, but I don't know that we're doing that with natural selection.
Right.
Right.
We've been doing this for 2 hours and I
gotta
move
get
on.
Going myself.
I
apologize if I've been hostile towards you.
That's fine. Whatever. I had two really quick questions. When you talked to this with Forrest, did he argue that it's, well, no, the selection happens on the gene level or what? Or did he say phenotypes are selected?
He was under the impression that pleiotropy could solve the issue, but I don't see how it could. Because I think in like cases, yeah, but like we're talking about cases where pleiotropy isn't even like relevant.
Another thing would be a lot of biologists say that, well, actually, natural selection doesn't select for anything. It selects against things.
Yeah, that's Rosenberg's response, but selection against is still an intentional context. Selecting against some trait rather than the ride along or whatever trait is still like, you can still phrase that as a selection for, but even if we don't worry about that, it still risks preserving the truth value once we swap out the coextensional traits, which is what the intentional context is worried about. That like, you know, we can't say that Lois Lane believes Clark Kent can fly because she doesn't know that Clark Kent is Superman, right? And the reason that that matters is that under natural selection, swapping out the right along trait and saying that that one was selected against is going to be an issue because for the same reason that the causal mechanism
I feel like every time I try to translate this into a biological experiment, I'm just rejected and say I must use philosophical language.
Yeah. So, Carl, real quick.
Philosophical language, it's a priori objection. It doesn't have anything to do with empirics. The same way that if I had some interpretation of quantum mechanics, some guy could just armchair look at my theory and point out a problem in principle with the language I use, with the phenomena that I invoke. He doesn't have to go out and do any empirical work at all to show that in principle I can't do what I'm purporting to do. If your alternative is to say that every theory is not susceptible to some type of objection like that. And that's ridiculous.
But what I'm saying, what might be also true is that, yes, this argument holds in specific cases, but not in all cases.
All the people that are like, oh, this guy's going to drive me to drinking are the same people that follow my main. Like, you guys should, like, figure it out.
If I'm saying there is no extensional problem, why then is this still even... Why does this even matter?
We're going to have to do a part two. Because it's been 2 hours at this point. And we have an echo. But thank you, Carl.
No, that's fine. Yeah, appreciate it. We'll talk about it later.
Yeah. So, like, the issue I kept having there, Simon, was the extensional intentional thing. I fully admit that's very hard to keep track of and make sense of. But what I kept doing was he kept saying, well, those are problems because you can't address, like, the free rider problem, for example. And then you and I kept trying to say, well, no, this is how we can address that. And then he kept saying, yeah, but you don't know the definition of blank, and that doesn't actually address what I was saying. And I was not trying to be slippery or anything like that, or try to, like, change the subject in a subtle way. I was not trying to do any cheap tricks. I was just saying, I'm hearing you tell us that natural selection can't explain this, and then we're trying to give you scientific examples where it can. And so it was just frustrating.